Welcome back, friend of the show, Greg Potter, our resident PhD that I've adopted, who shares his wisdom with us frequently. The last episode had a great conversation about nutrition and how to think about fueling our adventures. And honestly, I wasn't sure how that episode would go because it was quite different to what we'd normally done. And I just got such great feedback. It's one of our most popular episodes. And so it was a no-brainer for me to invite Greg back and have a little conversation about sleep. So Greg, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Jane. It's great to hear that it was well received.
Yeah, it was really well received. People loved it. And, you know, I think that you, I don't want to embarrass you, but what you do really nicely is you use the science, but you help us normal folks understand it. And I think that was generally the feedback that I got. And I remember that I contacted you the first time because I'd listened to your talk about nutrition and other factors on the Beyond the Ultimate podcast. And I listened to that podcast episode 4 or 5 times, and I've never done that before with any podcast. I've never done it since. So that tells you that you've got some really good stuff in there. So this could be another one of those, but unlike the last time where we kind of said, well, let's talk about nutrition in the context of adventure, because that's the broad theme of the podcast. I think on this occasion, I'd quite like to talk just more generally about the fundamentals of sleep. And part of the reason for feeling that way was that, a couple of years, about 4 years ago now, I was a busy, my story, and I've talked about it on the pod before, but I was a busy, stressed kind of senior executive in a very large billion-dollar company. And I kind of felt like everybody else owned my day and I didn't. And I was just out of control. The emails were mounting up. The stress was overloading. I would wake up in the morning and I would already be exhausted, and I would be fatigued and lethargic. And I was just surviving the whole day. And then I was making probably a lot of the classic mistakes, like I was overdosing on caffeine. I was eating certain foods that would help in the near term, but ultimately weren't helping in the long term. And I decided that I needed to read more about the science of, health, well-being, and sleep. And I started to kind of hack my life, for want of a better description. And it really worked, And sleep was one of those ones that surprised me the most, because I kind of had always just been a survivor. I get what I get, and I'd been able to travel the world, lots of flights every year, just surviving from one time zone to the next. And then when I started to really understand sleep, at the level that I did at the time, and you've since helped me more, I started to realize just having a better understanding of the type of sleep that I needed and how I operated, in a sleep deprivation mode was just really helpful for me. So that's a bit of a long-winded intro, but that was really why I wanted to chat to you today, because I've heard you talk so many times about sleep, and I just think people are going to find this really helpful, just in general, irrespective of what adventures they may be going on.
Good stuff.
So I thought maybe why don't we kick off with, a nice starter for 10. Talk us through, the fundamentals of sleep, because it's one of those things that we all do every day, but perhaps most of us don't really fully understand, what sleep is, why we need it, how it works, and what are some of the effects of not getting enough sleep.
Okay. There are quite a few things to discuss, so I'll try and cover quite a lot of ground in not too much time, but how long-winded I can be. So
you go for it, mate. You just the mic is yours, and if I feel like we're going down a rabbit hole, I'll pull you back.
Good stuff. So usually begin by framing responses in the context of evolution. And sleep is strange in that while we sleep, we can't eat. We're at our most vulnerable. We can't pass on our genes. And so there should have been strong evolutionary pressure against the development of sleep. However, it seems that practically all species have sleep-like behavior. So there's a famous sleep researcher named Alan Retchafin who said that if sleep doesn't serve an absolutely vital function, then it's surely the greatest mistake that evolution ever made. And I think we've come to realize in recent years that sleep is important for all aspects of our biology and behavior. And one thing that I'd like to convey is that we should view sleep as an investment in tomorrow. And I think I've been guilty previously of discussing all of the negative consequences of poor sleep, which can come in many different forms. But it's key to understand that if you take somebody who's not sleeping that well and improve their sleep, then all sorts of good things happen. And just to touch on a few of these, lots of studies have looked at what's known as sleep extension, in which you take people who habitually don't get enough sleep, which is probably true of you during your executive days, Jay, and you ask them to spend more time in bed and hence prolong their sleep. And provided that their sleep quality remains similar to what it was previously, they experience a range of beneficial effects both on their health and performance. So, for example, you tend to see a reduction in appetite and cravings for sweet and salty foods. You might see changes in food intake, for example, a reduction in sugar intake. But also, beyond those feelings and behaviors, you see improvements in various health outcomes. There's been work looking at middle-aged men finding that they see a boost in their testosterone and improvement in blood sugar regulation, for instance. And that blood sugar regulation is important to risk of various different diseases such as diabetes and dementia. You also see changes in brain function, sharper attention, improvements in memory and more. And then with respect to physical performance, many different types of athletes have been studied. And just as some examples of this, basketball players from Stanford University experienced a range of improvements in various performance metrics when they went through 6 weeks of extending their time in bed to 10 hours per night. They were faster in multi-directional sprints, their reaction times sped up, and they also were more accurate in their shooting performance. And then if you look at endurance athletes, then there's been some work on triathletes finding that if you ask them to complete a cycling time trial and you manipulate how much time in bed they have, when you reduce their time in bed by 30%, their performance deteriorates by a couple of minutes. And this test lasts roughly 60 minutes to give you an idea of the magnitude of the decrement. Whereas if you extend their time in bed by 30%, then their performance improves by a couple of minutes. And you also see changes in some more coordination-dependent performance metrics. For example, if you take tennis players and you have them extend their time in bed, their serving accuracy improves. So with that said, the other side of this, as I touched on, is that when people don't sleep well, many different aspects of their biology suffer. And one thing to convey is that there are different dimensions of sleep health. And a lot of the time people focus on sleep duration, how much sleep we get per night. But the reality is that it's not just sleep duration that's important. Sleep timing matters too. And shift workers will be all too familiar with this. If you try and sleep at a time of day which your body's clock is promoting wakefulness, you won't sleep very well. And that might explain why shift workers on average get something like 1 hour less sleep than their non-shift working counterparts. Then there is sleep quality, and there are different aspects of sleep quality. There's how long it takes you to fall asleep. In healthy sleepers, that number should probably be 30 minutes or less. There is sleep efficiency, which is the proportion of time that you're in bed that you're actually asleep. So if you're in bed for 10 hours and you're asleep for 8 hours, then your sleep will be 80% efficient. And for adults, if your sleep efficiency is about 85% or higher, that's generally considered healthy. There are some other aspects of sleep quality too, such as how well you breathe during sleep that matter. And then there's your daytime function. And hopefully during the day, you feel alert and you aren't prone to sleepiness. And of course, micro sleeps, which some people might have experienced, contribute to all sorts of problems. As one example, if you fall asleep at the wheel, you're more likely to experience a traffic accident. So with that said, just to touch on some of the ways by which sleep compromises our health. If you look at immune function, which is particularly relevant right now, then people who regularly get less sleep than they need are not only more prone to certain types of infection, but relevant to some people who are getting, say, SARS-CoV-2 vaccines. When people don't get as much sleep around the time of vaccination, they produce fewer antibodies. And sometimes that's clinically relevant in that they might need an additional booster dose to produce sufficient antibodies to protect them meaningfully against the given disease. Then you see effects of sleep on body weight regulation. I mentioned appetite earlier. And if you look at all the different studies in which people don't get enough sleep, on average, they consume something like 250 calories more per day. They don't burn more energy. And if that continued over the course of a year, the cumulative positive energy balance would amount to roughly the amount of energy that's in 12 kilos of fat tissue. So that could be meaningful. I'm not saying that someone would gain 12 kilos necessarily, but hopefully the point remains. And then you see changes in things like your blood sugar control, your cardiovascular health, and also your reproductive function. And that's not to mention how well your brain works. Not only are certain aspects of brain health acutely compromised by poor sleep, your ability to attend to a given task or to memorize certain things, your capacity to learn new information is compromised too. And then there are the effects on mood and how well you interact with other people. There's research suggesting that people who don't get enough sleep aren't as empathic and are more prone to isolating themselves socially. And that could have knock-on effects to other people, such that people more generally become more socially isolated, which I think is an especially large problem right now. And then finally, there is, of course, the notion of beauty sleep. And it turns out that there's something to that. There's been some work by Swedish researchers in which they've deprived adults of sleep. And when you then show people photos of the adults when they've either had sleep or have been deprived of sleep, they rate the photos of sleep-deprived people as being less physically attractive and less healthy. And they also say that they'd be less likely to socialize with those people. So hopefully that tees up the rest of the conversation nicely. But I think it's fair to say that sleep's quite important.
Yeah, that's amazing, Greg. As always, there's just so much there to dive into, isn't there? But I guess I love, by the way, the idea that sleep is an investment in tomorrow, because I think that the message there is that kind of what you do in advance of going to sleep and how you approach sleep is really powerful for tomorrow. Because often people will say, you've heard people say, our life is too short for sleep, you know, and all of those, we're kind of bombarded with those kind of bullish expressions of, you know, if you're a hustler and you're ambitious, then you don't sleep. And I think there's clearly some bravado in that.
There's some irony too.
Right.
Some people will say, I'll sleep when I'm dead. And if you look at the relationships between those different dimensions of sleep health that I mentioned earlier and all-cause mortality, so risk of dying from any cause, they all associate with mortality.
Right.
And as one example, you tend to find that people who report sleeping about 7 hours per night have the lowest risk of dying from any cause. But people who sleep less than that are much more likely to. Interestingly, people who sleep more than 7 hours per night are also more likely to. But one thing to clear up, and this is a point of contention, is that it seems that certain health problems will cause people to need more sleep. And not only that, but sometimes there is misreporting or misunderstanding of certain questions that leads people to say that they say sleep 9 hours per night. But what they mean is that they spend 9 hours in bed per night, but they're actually asleep 6 of those hours, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does. Can we talk about that kind of links to the whole concept of sleep efficiency, right? That people maybe think about the amount of sleep they get as when they go to bed and when they get up in the morning. But there's this piece around, okay, but are you actually asleep during that time? How long does it take you to fall asleep? Can we double click on that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what might make sense is to give people some strategies to improve their sleep efficiency. But before we get to that, I'll just add that some people feel like they spend a lot of time awake during the night. However, they aren't necessarily actually awake at those times. This is common in insomnia, and it's known as sleep state misperception. And the reason for this is likely that if you look at somebody's patterns of electrical activity in the brain while they sleep, then it's not necessarily that the entire brain is in a sleep-like state at once. And it's become increasingly clear over time that sleep is actually a local phenomenon. You can selectively stimulate certain parts of the brain. And with increased use of those parts of the brain, they become more and more prone to showing sleep-like behavior. And what you see in these people who have sleep state misperception is that a part of the brain that seems to be involved in wakefulness and perhaps consciousness, named the precuneus, shows wake-like behavior during sleep. And another example of this would be sleepwalking. Somebody might be fast asleep in many ways, but the parts of the brain, so the motor cortex that are involved in moving, might be showing wake-like behavior. So with that said, in terms of reducing nighttime awakenings and sleeping more efficiently, there are lots of different things that can underlie this. Everything from somebody experiencing pain to someone needing to pee during the night, noises disturbing somebody's sleep, being too hot or cold, certain life transitions, the menopause, for instance, and then also things like whether someone has a bed partner and some sleep disorders too. So obstructive sleep apnea is a condition in which the upper airway occasionally collapses during sleep. It's really problematic. It's underdiagnosed. But if we just touch on some common issues that people face, then I think one of the most important things to implement is a series of different strategies that are based on something known as stimulus control of behavior, which might sound complex, but it's not really. The idea is just that because our brains are so good at creating associations between things, certain stimuli lead to certain behaviors. As an example, if you're driving and you're approaching a red light, then because you practice driving over time, you know that you should be braking in response to that, you reflexively brake, or at least I hope you will. And what happens in certain sleep problems, such as insomnia, is that as people spend more time in bed awake, they learn to associate their bed with stress and with being awake. And so you see what's known as conditioned arousal, where somebody might be starting to feel sleepy in the living room, they go through to their bedroom, they get in bed, and all of a sudden they feel wide awake. So what they need to do is apply these principles that I mentioned. And there are a few of these. One would be, in this instance, you want to avoid napping during the day. The reason is that even a brief nap will pay off pressure to sleep that's accumulated with prior wakefulness. And in a way, sleep is a bit like hunger, in that in general, the longer that you've been awake, the sleepier or the hungrier that you feel. But with that said, if you're used to eating meals at certain times of day, or if you're used to being in bed at certain times of day, you'll see peaks and troughs in how hungry you feel or how sleepy you feel. So by napping, you build that hunger for sleep without paying it off during the nap. And what that means is that when you then go to bed in the evening, you're likely to fall asleep quickly and stay asleep. Now, related to that, only ever go to bed when you're actually sleepy. Let's say that you're trying to extend your sleep because you want to experience some of those benefits that I mentioned earlier. If that's the case, then just because you were thinking that 10:30 p.m. is the best bedtime for you, if 10:30 p.m. rolls around and you're not sleepy, you should not go to bed. Next, if you wake up during the night, or if you don't fall asleep at the start of the night within 15 minutes or so, and when I say 15 minutes, you shouldn't be looking at an alarm clock and tracking time. You should just go by your own internal sense of time passing. Then you should get out of bed and go and do something relaxing in a different room and only return to bed when you're sleepy. So good things to do at this time would be, for example, reading a book in dim lighting. Or if you're a meditator, you can meditate.
Greg, I find that really interesting, because one of the things that, you know, that is out there is a belief that we have to kind of go to bed and get up at the same time every day. It has to be that consistency of sleep patterns. Is that essentially not true, or only sometimes true?
No, it matters. And returning to what I was saying earlier about those different dimensions of sleep health, within the sleep timing dimension, there's also variability. And that's true of all the dimensions. And the more variable your sleep timing is, the greater your risk of certain health problems.
Okay.
So that type of regularity is important. The issue is that you can't control when you feel sleepy in the evening. You can influence it if you consume two espressos 30 minutes before bed, then that's probably going to influence how sleepy you feel when you're planning to go to bed. But what you can control more is when you wake up in the morning. And so if you're struggling with your sleep, then getting out of bed at a regular time each day makes a lot of sense. And while I don't advocate that everybody uses an alarm clock, especially in insomnia, it can be really transformative. Not only because that way you are maintaining a more consistent sleep-wake schedule, but because you're getting out of bed at the same time each day, you're making sure that you build lots of sleep pressure during the day, or hunger for sleep, as I was discussing previously. You're also influencing your body's clock, which is the other mechanism that most strongly influences your sleep-wake cycle. And by getting out of bed at the same time each day, you're also influencing things like when you're exposed to light during the day. And it's your exposure to light that's the most important cue in synchronizing your body's clock each day with the world around you. Because say you went and lived in a cave that was devoid of changes in light and temperature, what you would find is that your body's clock doesn't tick at precisely 24 hours each day. And so it needs to be reset each day or aligned with the world around you. And this is one of the reasons that camping is so good for sleep. People spend much more time outdoors when they go camping. And what you find is that within even a short period of time, people's clocks tightly synchronize with the natural light-dark cycle. Right. And going into the camping, you might have some people who are very early birds and some people who are night owls. You might go to bed 8 hours later than the early birds. Within 3 days, that difference is dramatically reduced, such that most people are pretty much going to bed at the same time each day.
That's fascinating. I love that. I'm wondering whether that would, one of the things that I've been doing kind of on and off now, well, pretty consistently actually for about the last year, is when I wake up in the morning, I make sure that I very quickly go outside, just because I found that that kind of, I find that energizes me. I guess there was no science behind that in my mind. I just felt like it was a win, and it got me connected with the outdoors, which, you know, is really important to me. So it seems like there's a little bit of science to that.
There's actually quite a lot of science to that. And okay. I'll touch on a few different aspects of that science. So one is what I mentioned earlier, which is known as entrainment. That synchronizing process that aligns your body's clock with the world around you and is primarily influenced by the light-dark cycle. Although, interestingly, it seems that the timing of your nutrition is involved in setting the time of some of the clocks in your body. And it's likely that every cell in your body has its own molecular timekeeping mechanism. I don't want to go off track, but the practical considerations here are that if you can spend plenty of time outdoors each day, ideally at least an hour in daylight, and if you can maintain relatively regular meal times, maybe waiting at least half an hour after you've woken up in the morning and finishing your final meal by at least 2 hours before your planned bedtime, then you're going to help ensure that your body's clock maintains close alignment with the world around you, but also the different clocks in your body are running at roughly the same speed. So there's that circadian biology element of the importance of light exposure, but there are others too. One of these is that we understand that patterns of light exposure at the level of the eye are important to mood. And there's a structure in the brain named the perihabenular nucleus that seems to be particularly important to that process. And if you have ever experienced seasonal affective disorder, then you'll be all too familiar with this relationship. Then there are the effects of light exposure on brain function. And you mentioned that you feel that getting outside in daylight is energizing. And sure enough, if you expose somebody to bright light, you see a boost in their alertness and a reduction in their sleepiness. Then there are the effects of UVB radiation on vitamin D synthesis that most people will probably be familiar with. And if you're in the Northern Hemisphere, then, or the Southern Hemisphere, if you're quite far from the equator, then there'll be certain times of the year when your body won't be synthesizing much vitamin D because you won't get sufficient UVB radiation. But briefly, vitamin D is important to all sorts of different bodily processes, including perhaps sleep-wake regulation, but its most established roles are on things such as bone mineralization. Obviously, vitamin D deficiency leads to rickets and immune function as well. And then there are potential effects of exposure to light on cardiometabolic health. Some interesting research from recent times has shown that if you expose people to daylight, then you see a reduction in their blood pressure. And that seems to be because of changes in the signaling of something known as nitric oxide. And that influences the dilation of blood vessels. And by dilating more, blood pressure tends to drop in response to light exposure.
I just find that fascinating. I also love it when I chat to you because sometimes I feel stuff, but I don't know why. And then you explain it with the science, which is always great to hear. The seasonal affective disorder is really interesting to me. I kind of wanted to pause on that for a moment just because, you know, two people in my family I know really suffer with that. And it can be really debilitating for them. So are there any, and at that time, I think there feels like there's a correlation between that and the quality of their sleep. And I don't know whether that's just anecdotal or sounds like it's not. But what would be the tips? Because I know a lot of people listening will struggle with that as the days get darker and they're getting less access to sunlight. What are the tips?
I think a key one is if you can't get outside for at least an hour each day during daylight, then you might consider using a light therapy lamp. And people might have come across these and thought, oh, I wonder if that's a fad or not. It's not. And you need to get one that emits at least 10,000 lux. Lux is the unit of light intensity, and one lux is the intensity of light that's emitted by a candle held 1 meter from the eye. And it's important to recognize that the intensity of light that we're exposed to indoors differs dramatically from the intensity of light that we get outdoors on a sunny day in the middle of the day. In this room where I'm sat at the moment, I'm probably exposed to something like 500 lux. And if I go outdoors, it's nearly midday here. Right now, I'd probably be exposed to 110,000 lux, something like that. So we're talking about orders of magnitude and difference potentially between being outdoors. And those simple light therapy lamps can expose you to an intensity of light that's much stronger than what you'd otherwise get indoors. And you want to use that for at least half an hour each day. Generally, they're best used in the morning. Something that I haven't described is that when you're exposed to light influences the timing of your body's clock, such that if you get lots of that type of high intensity light exposure that's rich in short wavelength light, and this is the kind of light that you get outdoors in the middle of a sunny day.
Yeah.
If you get that type of light from between about 2 hours before you naturally wake up and about 2 hours after you naturally wake up, then you'll tend to anchor the timing of your body's clock early in the day. So if you're a real night owl, then that can help you advance your body's clock such that you feel sleepier in the evening and can go to bed earlier. And if you're waking up to an alarm clock and thereby compressing your sleep, then that can be helpful. At the other end of the day, if you expose yourself to lots of that type of light within 2 to 4 hours of going to bed, then you'll tend to shift your clock later. And let's say that you are an elderly person, you're 70 years old, and you're prone to waking up at 3:30 in the morning, and you'd really like to wake up at 5:30 in the morning, that can actually be helpful. So getting outdoors at the end of the day, say during the summer, can help you better align your body's clock with the world around you, and thereby potentially improve your quality of life. But for most people with seasonal affective disorder, getting that type of light exposure, not that long after waking up in the morning, maybe in a couple of hours after waking up, can be quite transformative. But then another thing to mention is that when you're physically active can also influence your body's clock and certainly influence your sleep too. And coupling that type of light exposure with some exercise will likely have additive effects both on that change in the timing of your body's clock, but also on things such as your mood. Exercise has very well-established antidepressant effects, and some of those effects are probably mediated by its effects on sleep. If you take somebody who's relatively sedentary and you put them through a structured exercise training program, then provided they're not doing way too much exercise, you tend to see that they fall asleep faster, they sleep more efficiently, they feel subjectively like their sleep quality is better, and they sleep slightly longer too. Mm. So if you can't get outdoors, then being indoors, using one of those light therapy lamps within a meter or so of yourself for at least half an hour and doing some physical activity at that time is likely to be quite a potent combination for you.
That's awesome advice. And I could risk taking us down a rabbit hole here, but you know, for my master's, I'm really fascinated by the, you know, the mental health benefits of being outdoors, and the light exposure piece that you're talking about is something that I've started reading more about. I find it really interesting. I put some polls out on my LinkedIn recently, and it got some really interesting feedback. One of the things that I was curious to find out more about was how many days a week people take time out of their working day to get outside, and critically in my mind was also be device free. And yeah. 40% of people who responded, it got a really good response rate. 40% of people, or 39% of people, said they virtually never take time out of their working day to get outside. And it was just like fascinating to me. So I followed up. I was like, okay, if you said I hardly ever get outdoors for a device-free break during the day, what is the key reason? And 84% of people said it was because their workload was too high. So you know, and then I followed up, like, if your employer would do more to encourage you to be outside and culturally it was more acceptable for you to take a break, mm-hmm. get outside, get device free, would that help? And 88% of people said yes. So, you know, I know it's not a controlled study, but it is fascinating insight into what people are grappling with. And so I think as is often the case when we talk about health and well-being and the advice that people can follow, it's the practical application of those things. And so I think in this environment, the idea of kind of a busy work day affecting somebody's sleep patterns and their ability to get outside is definitely one of the barriers, isn't it?
There's actually a huge amount to unpack in what you just said. So I'll just touch on some of the science underlying it.
Yeah.
So first, if you look at cognitive performance during the day, then there are several variables that influence it, unsurprisingly. And I mentioned light exposure, that's one of them. One of them is, of course, the task itself and the cognitive load of the task. So the load that's placed on the person's cognitive system. And there are various factors that will shape that, such as the presence of time pressure. So if you have a deadline, for example, and there are many of those factors that you can't really change, but there are some that you can, and probably the most important of those that you can is switching between tasks. It's very clear that task switching impairs performance. Mm-hmm. And if you can do what you can to prevent yourself from task switching, let's say that you use website blocking apps, for example, you leave your phone on airplane mode in a different room, etc., then you're likely to be more efficient at work. So next, there's the time of day effect on cognitive performance too. And interestingly, a lot of people have experienced this, but not necessarily realized that there's a clear dip in cognitive function around the middle of the waking day, which is typically about the hottest time of day. A lot of people refer to that as the post-lunch slump. It generally doesn't actually have that much to do with lunch. It's driven by a temporary dip in the drive to be awake, which is regulated by your body's clock. And this presumably has an evolutionary basis in that if you think about our ancestors, say, on the plains of Africa, then it would have been hot at that time of day. And that type of radiation from the sun could be damaging to us. So escaping the heat and the stress that comes with that the middle of the day would have been adaptive. And that's why in temperate climates, it's common to see a siesta culture.
Right.
So avoiding scheduling your most strenuous work at that time of day can be helpful. Then there's a time on task effect. The longer that you've been doing a particular cognitive task, the more prone you become to errors. And interestingly, that's exacerbated by recent sleep loss. So if you haven't getting enough sleep in the build-up to that particular day, it's also exacerbated by doing a task during your biological nighttime, which is that time of day when you'd otherwise be sleeping. So say that you're trying to pull an all-nighter to get something in time for a deadline, and you've also been burning the candle, not getting enough sleep, and you've been working for several hours, you're going to be very prone to doing poor work at that time. Now, with all of that said, circling back to what you were discussing, it's really important between bouts of work to get out and to take your mind off the work. So returning to something I mentioned, which is that sleep is a local phenomenon in the brain. If you think about the fact that while you're working, certain parts of the brain are basically driving your performance in that work, that process places demands on those brain structures. And if you then go outside or you take a break, but you're still engaged in some sort of task, they might continue to work. And so they're going to be more prone to showing sleep-like behavior, which is going to impair your cognition. If, however, you temporarily take a proper break from work and you let your mind wander, then you not only give those brain circuits a rest, but also if you have concerns, and it's these types of concerns that commonly disrupt people's sleep, especially concerns about work. So interestingly, sleep issues are actually most common at the start of the working week, then your brain will tag some of those concerns for later processing during sleep. And this type of mind wandering, I think, is really underappreciated as a way to improve your sleep. And related to this, the better that you sleep, the better your performance at work will be. So based on everything I just said, getting outside, letting your mind wander, being device-free is a really, really important strategy if you want to be more productive at work, if you want to support your sleep health too, and support your general health. Not only that, but if you couple that with being in nature, then you experience additional beneficial effects. I mean, simply exposing people to photos of beautiful natural environments can acutely reduce blood pressure, etc. So actually getting outdoors, going for a walk in the woods or among trees, going and sitting in the park, whatever it might be, is going to be better than just taking that break and being in a built environment.
Yeah, I mean, I had this conversation with somebody because I read a few papers about this, and I had this conversation with somebody recently where they said, it's all very well, but you know, I work in a really kind of industrial urban area. And, and my argument was there's still benefit to getting outdoors. And I cited that idea that you can just, evidence that you can even just look at photos of nature and you will feel calmer and you know, there'll be some physiological changes. So yeah, I think it's fascinating. I know it's probably a bit of a rabbit hole, but I do, I do also think that it's fascinating because I think that we, you know, we spend a lot of our time working, and if you work in an environment where culturally it's not considered acceptable to get outside, you know, that's really difficult. But the irony is that the evidence seems to suggest, as you've just articulated, that the more you get outside or the more consistently you get outside for a device-free break and get outdoors during the working day, the more effective you'll be when you are working.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to zoom in on the devices briefly, it's quite clear that different types of problematic smartphone use do associate with poorer sleep, as well as worse mental health. And that's not to say that there aren't good ways to use these devices. There absolutely are. But in a way that's akin to diet, there are junky ways to use these devices, as there are junk foods. And so practically, I think if people can stop using devices such as their smartphones by at least 30 minutes before they go to bed at night, they're likely to experience some beneficial effects. And this has been shown very clearly in young people. There was an interesting paper published last year showing that if you take youngsters and you have them turn off their phones 30 minutes before bed, then if they do that consistently, they fall asleep faster, they sleep longer, their sleep quality improves. And as a result of the change in their sleep, in the following days, they feel better and some aspects of their cognition sharpen too, such as working memory.
Love it. There's definitely some great advice in there. I want to be conscious of time. There's just so much to talk about here, isn't there? But you kind of touched on something earlier that stuck in my mind that I really want to talk about, because I'm a coffee junkie. I love coffee. And over the years, I've tried to find the right balance with coffee in my life. Because, I mean, you actually, Resilient Nutrition just recently, just yesterday or today, put out a blog, which I really loved, about, you know, there's some really good stuff about coffee. It does get a bit of a bad rap sometimes. And I really enjoy it. So if people haven't read it, they should definitely go and check that out. But can we just talk about caffeine and its impact on sleep a little bit? Because it's clear that, like you said earlier, if you drop two double espressos an hour before you go to bed, you're probably going to have some problems going to sleep. And that fundamentally could have onward implications. So I think people understand that, but equally, like, how do people find that balance between coffee and sleep, and what advice do you have?
Sure. And once again, there's actually a huge amount here to unpack, so I won't try and unpack it.
Sorry.
No, that's not a problem. But briefly, when people speak about coffee, I think they often think that it is a tasty form of caffeine and there's not much else in it. And in reality, there are over 1,000 different chemicals in coffee. And this is true of many other caffeinated products too. Cocoa products, for example, tea, etc. And interestingly, if you look at the epidemiology of coffee use, and you take people, you ask them how many coffees they drink per day, and then you track their health over time, you tend to find that people who consume 2 to 4 coffees per day live the longest, have the best health, have the lowest risk of various different diseases such as Parkinson's and diabetes and obesity. And as a result of that, you might think that coffee is driving that association. I'm not necessarily convinced that that's the case. And one of the problems with coffee is that it comes in so many different forms.
Yeah.
And if you just think about the fact that there are different types of coffees, so there is Robusta, there is Arabica, and there are differences between those. Robusta tends to contain more caffeine, for instance. There are different processing methods of those coffees too. There are different brewing conditions that you can use. What that means is that some coffees that aren't decaf coffees can have less than 50 milligrams of caffeine per serving. But there are other coffees which are based on beans that are selectively bred for high caffeine contents and that are processed using methods that concentrate some of those chemicals that can have something like a gram of caffeine per serving. So there's an enormous difference between them. And that's one of the tricky things with coffee. Quite often people are consuming it and they're not quite sure how much caffeine is in it. And so I think that if people can try different types of coffees, find one that they enjoy the taste of, and get some sense about how it influences them, then that's likely to be a good thing. And there are some websites out there with lots of information about the caffeine contents of commonly consumed foods. One of these is caffeineinformer.com. And I'd suggest going there, and if you have a favorite coffee, seeing if there's information about the caffeine contents of that particular coffee there. And then with respect to the quantity of caffeine that you consume, the issue here is that there's enormous variability between people in how they metabolize caffeine based on a variety of factors. So one is liver function. If you take somebody who has some sort of chronic liver disease, such as non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, then you might find that it will take that person several days to reduce the peak concentration of caffeine that they experience after drinking coffee to half that peak concentration. So caffeine is staying in their system for several days, whereas for most people, the half-life of caffeine, which I just described, is close to 6 hours. And then there are also factors such as differences in the genetics of certain receptors that influence how caffeine affects us. And because of that, it's really hard to give people clear guidance and generic recommendations.
Sure.
But I think as a rough starting point, limiting your regular caffeine intake to no more than about 3 milligrams of caffeine per kilogram body weight per day So if you were 70 kilos, that'd be 210 milligrams of caffeine per day. And that is roughly the amount of caffeine that's in 4 instant coffees or a store-bought Americano or 2 espresso lungos or 3 short espressos is a good way to go. And then the other aspect of this is the importance of when you consume the caffeine.
Yeah. Because that's what I was going to ask you, because is there some, you know, a lot of us will have it kind of first thing when we wake up. Is there some kind of timing impact here as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And a clear example of this is some work that Ken Wright did a few years ago, about 5 years ago, which gave people about 3 milligrams of caffeine, just under that, not long before they went to bed. And they found that not only did the caffeine prolong how long it took them to fall asleep and impair sleep quality, but also delay the timing of their body's clocks. And so caffeine isn't just influencing that sleep hunger that I mentioned earlier. It can also delay the body clock when consumed late in the day. And so bearing in mind that there's that variation between people and how they metabolize caffeine, I think not consuming any caffeine any later than about 8 hours before planned bedtime is a good way to go. So if your target bedtime is 10 p.m., then stopping caffeine by 2 p.m. is probably smart. But again, bear in mind there are big differences between people. And something to add here is that it's easy to assume now that caffeine is bad for sleep across the board. And I just don't think that that's necessarily true. There was some interesting research not long ago on healthy young people, and it gave them quite a large dose of caffeine and split that dose of caffeine. And the final dose of caffeine was about halfway through the waking day. And they did that for several days. And they basically found that that type of regular caffeine intake in these people who are habitual caffeine consumers had zero effect on sleep architecture. So if you normally drink coffee or tea and you're not struggling with your sleep, and you're not consuming caffeine too late in the day, you have nothing to worry about. And there are all sorts of other health benefits that you'll experience from consuming drinks such as coffee and tea and my personal favorite, cocoa. But if you're struggling with your sleep, it's probably become relatively more important. And it's very easy to get stuck in a vicious cycle in which your sleep is deteriorating and you're trying to self-medicate through caffeine consumption. And if you then suddenly try to go cold turkey, you'll probably experience a variety of withdrawal symptoms, which commonly include things like headaches, sleepiness, irritability, and sometimes actually insomnia at night. So you might prefer to taper off caffeine. And let's say that you're an avid coffee consumer. If that's the case, then I would just swap out some of the coffee for decaf initially.
Yeah.
And let's say that you were consuming 6 coffees a day. Maybe you start by going to 5 with 1 decaf and then 4 with 2 decafs, etc., until you're down at 1 coffee a day. And I think at that level, you're unlikely to experience any ill effects.
Well, it's an N of 1, right? But that is essentially, you just described what I did. So about 12 months ago now, I kind of felt like I was just having too much coffee and sleep was a little bit shaky. So I just cut right down, and I now have a cup, you know, I'll have a decaf coffee when I fairly early on when I've woken up, and I'll have 1 caffeinated coffee in the morning, sometime mid morning. And then I might have 1 final decaf coffee later on in the day. But essentially that means that the only caffeinated coffee I'm having, or highly caffeinated coffee I'm having, is kind of mid morning. And then the only other caffeine I'd really have, based on the food and the diet that I have, is probably the morning resilient nutrition that I take on board, the caffeinated one. And if I have any in the afternoon, I have the decaffeinated.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a good way to go.
Well, it really felt like it helped me. Sleep quality was much better. I found that I was falling asleep. I use a Whoop. One of the questions I had for you, I was curious to know, you know, there's lots of tech out there that people can use to kind of track wakefulness and sleep times and even recovery. And I was curious to know if you had an opinion on those. I use a Whoop, and that's how I kind of know how much sleep I got relative to, you know, perhaps what I needed. Don't know whether you have an opinion on Whoop or any others and what tech people could use if they wanted to.
Yeah, as usual, I have lots of opinions.
I thought you might. Loaded question, right?
Yeah, and I think that these devices can be really helpful. And when misused, they can be harmful. Mm-hmm. And for people who are already quite anxious about their sleep, I generally tend to push them away from using them. Right. But if you, say, regularly don't get enough sleep, and you feel sleepy and fatigued, then they can be really helpful because they'll alert you to roughly how much time you're spending in bed each night and how much sleep you're getting. And the thing to attend to is the long-term trend in your sleep data, because while the devices aren't necessarily that accurate, and to be honest, I wouldn't look at the sleep stage data. We haven't spoken about sleep stages today, but you go through cycles of sleep roughly every 90 minutes during your sleep. And sleep is broadly divided into two different types. There's non-REM sleep and there's REM sleep. REM sleep is named rapid eye movement sleep, and that's because of characteristic eye movements that occur during that stage of sleep. REM sleep is when we have our most vivid dreams, although we dream in all stages of sleep. And it's very important to things like emotion regulation, to exploring previously unexplored associations between different things, and can be therefore helpful for things like creativity. But it also has some bodily functions, such as regulating your vascular health. Whereas non-REM sleep is split into three different categories, 1, 2, and 3, which progressively increase in depth, meaning that it's harder to awake someone. And 1 is just like a bridge from wakefulness to sleep. 2 is important to things such as memory formation, and it's actually that stage of sleep in which we spend the majority of time asleep each evening. And then 3, the deeper stage of sleep, has lots of different housekeeping functions. It's important to things like the formation of memory in the immune system. It's important to blood sugar control as well. It's during that stage of sleep in which we produce most of our growth hormone, which helps restore different connective tissues in our body, such as tendons, etc. And if you look at the distribution of these sleep stages across the night, then you get more non-REM sleep in the first half of the night. But by the end of the night, you spend more time in REM sleep. And that's why quite often in the morning, if you wake up, you'll remember your dreams. Now, with that said, because each of those different stages has some slightly different functions, your sleep architecture, as it's known, does matter. But right now, unless you're using a head-worn wearable, such as the Dream 2 headband, I don't think that these finger-worn or wrist-worn devices are actually that good at sleep staging, although there have been some interesting studies recently looking at devices such as the Whoop, suggesting that they do actually fare quite well compared to the gold standard method of assessing sleep stages, which is known as polysomnography. Mm-hmm. So just bear that in mind. But the issue here is just that what's happened in recent years is that those people who are anxious about their sleep that I mentioned earlier have overinterpreted their data from their wearables, and they've right. self-diagnosed sleep problems. They've turned up at sleep centers saying, my Fitbit tells me that I'm getting 2% deep sleep per night. I think I'm going to die. And then on further assessment, they're absolutely fine.
Yeah.
So just bear that in mind. But what I'll add to this is if you want to have one of these devices, then think about the totality of different measures that it gives you. Yeah. And so while personally, I'm not actually that interested in the sleep data for the most part, I think they can be really helpful. So say that you would like to increase your physical activity, because especially during the COVID-19 pandemic, you've become a bit more sedentary, and that affects you most strongly during short-term lockdowns. If that's the case, then if you get a wrist-worn device that gives you good activity data, in particular step count information, then tracking how many steps you're taking each day is helpful.
Right.
Likewise, if you're concerned that your burden of stress is accumulating over time, then the simple metric of resting pulse rate or resting heart rate, it's not really heart rate because it's taken not over the heart directly, but it's taken at the wrist or the finger, tells you quite a lot. Yeah. And in general, there's a positive relationship between how stressed you are and your resting pulse rate. So if you see that climbing, then you might think, maybe I should intervene to try and reduce my stress. And there are different ways you could go about that. You could try and do away with the stresses. You could introduce certain active coping strategies, such as exercise or breathing exercises, meditation, etc. So, sorry, that's not the clearest answer. It's very much
complicated. No, I think it's a great answer, and I think you said it really well when you kind of you indicated that with these all these wearables, you know, I think you're well advised not to dive too deeply into the minutiae, because the accuracy is kind of broadly questionable, right? And so really what those devices in my mind do is they can, certain devices, not all of them, but certain ones that maybe, you know, have a reasonably good degree of efficacy, you can use them for kind of general trends and just kind of guardrails, like, am I drifting too far one way or the other? Like, for example, again, not scientifically proven, but for me with Whoop, one of the things that I love with it, and the reason that I've used it consistently, unlike any other wearable I've tried throughout the years, and, you know, I've probably seen or tried them all, is that it provides some context to how I'm feeling. So if I wake up in the morning and I feel tired, in the past I would have just ignored it and ground out a workout and probably not had the best workout, probably not got the best you know, outcomes and physiological benefits, versus, you know, feeling like that, looking on my device and go, okay, yeah, I've got a pretty low recovery score. It looks like I, you know, sleep wasn't great, or, you know, maybe I just overexerted myself yesterday, overreached yesterday. I can just swap my workouts around and I'll do something that's lower strain today. And I've just found personally, again, it's an N of one, but I've just found that that's been really transformational for me. I know transformational is a word that's bandied around a lot, but it's helped me as a, you know, 44-year-old man, just not constantly grind myself into dust every time and realize that I don't always, I can work out smart rather than hard every time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the advantages of Whoop is that they do try to give you some guidance about things that will influence your different sleep metrics. And so if the Whoop band identifies that you seem more stressed than normal, it will actually push something to you to that effect. Whereas at least historically, many of these devices have just given people the data and then left it to those people to try and interpret the data.
Yep.
And in reality, what would be better would be to collect information from the person about various different things. So how well they feel, different sources of stress in their life, etc. And then to combine those data with the data that the device is gathering to try and meet the person in real time, give them personalized guidance about what might be appropriate to move the dial in the right direction.
Yeah, I love that, mate. And I honestly feel like we could have a 3-hour conversation on wearables, because, you know, I think it is a minefield, and they have become, you know, ubiquitous, haven't they? They're everywhere. Lots of people have them in various different brands. And it is interesting to see how they kind of now permeate society and how people use them. But my general feeling with wearables as a whole is kind of, so what, now what? Like, okay, so you've got the data. To your last point, you've got the data, but how many people actually know how to take that data and do something with it? And even Whoop, which I am generally a big fan of, you know, they send me a weekly performance assessment and you get a monthly performance assessment. I never read the weekly one, because it just feels too short of a time frame to be meaningful. The monthly one I find kind of generally interesting, but anyway, I'm going to take us down a whole rabbit hole there. Maybe just kind of last question or two, for people that are kind of really intrigued to learn more about sleep. You know, you're an incredibly well-read guy. A lot of the stuff that you're talking about has come from peer-reviewed research, but are there any good books out there that people could, you know, that you've read that you feel do a decent job of accounting for sleep in general that people could check out?
Yes, there are. And I think the pick of the bunch, certainly for people who are experiencing either transient or chronic insomnia, is entitled Quiet Your Mind and Get to Sleep. It's written by a couple of experts in insomnia. It's very practical. There are lots of helpful exercises in there. And it walks you through the most widely used and most efficacious form of helping people who have insomnia, which is known as cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. And within our conversation today, we've touched on some of the components of that. in particular stimulus control and some aspects of sleep hygiene. So I think that's probably the first one that I would recommend. In terms of books that are interesting but aren't quite so prescriptive, there are a couple that come to mind. One is The Nocturnal Brain by Guy Leschziner. Great book, fascinating. And it's basically a series of case studies of one of the UK's leading sleep clinicians, in which he discusses people who have different sleep disorders and their lives and some of the things that they experience, as well as some of the underlying biology. And then finally, I really liked Anthony Zadra and Robert Stickgold's recent book, When Brains Dream. It's a book that focuses on REM sleep specifically, and in it, they flesh out a model of REM sleep that I think Robert Stickgold largely came up with while writing the book, actually, named Next Up, or Network Exploration to Understand Possibilities. And they're both brilliant scientists. Robert Stickgold's had a very decorated career, and they're also both really nice guys as far as I can tell. And it's a brilliant book, so I'd certainly recommend that one too. And then in addition to those books, there are certain resources that I'd point people to. So one is, if your bed partner, if you have one, has ever witnessed you stop breathing during the night, or if you're a frequent snorer, if you wake up regularly with a dry mouth, you might well have sleep apnea. And there's a website, StopBang, StopBang.ca, that you can go to and answer a simple questionnaire that will help you identify whether you might well have sleep apnea. And then if it flags anything concerning, you can seek additional guidance. And there are also some online programs for people that I think are terrific. And because insomnia is the most common sleep disorder, I'll mention one named Sleepio, S-L-E-E-P-I-O. And if you're in the UK, I think you can access that for free. Certainly you can in certain postcodes. And it is a online cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia program. And it was developed by Colin Espy, who's surely one of the leading researchers in the field of studying insomnia. So I'd certainly recommend that one to you.
Greg, I always feel like every time we speak, I'm taking way too much of our relationship. I love chatting to you. You've become a really good friend, and I feel very much like a user, because I always get so much from our conversations. I always leave them feeling smarter than when I entered them, and today is no exception. It's just been great. Love chatting to you. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Jay. Absolute pleasure, mate.